As we begin tonight, I think I'll just try and summarise Ruth chapter 1, because I'm taking it for granted there are probably people here tonight who weren't here last Sunday night. And this is a series we're calling Redeeming Relationships. So each night there'll be an attention to the text of Ruth, and then some attempt just to draw out a few topical themes, and tonight we'll be looking later on at Christian workplace relationships. But let me just remind you of what happens in Ruth chapter 1, in case you weren't here last week. This story takes place at the time of the judges, and at the end of that book in the Old Testament, we're told that there's no king in the land, and everyone did right what they thought in their own eyes. So it was a time of tumult, a time of turbulence in Israel's history, a dark period. There wasn't any guaranteed law and order. Now, in the town of Bethlehem, that would become famous centuries later, there is a family. The husband is Elimelech. He has a wife, Naomi, and two sons. And there's a famine that comes to the land, and he decides that he's going to take them to a nearby country called Moab. Now, this is not a good move for Elimelech and his family. The Moabites were pagans who worshipped a god called Chemosh, and it wasn't unknown that they might indulge in child sacrifice. So we're to understand in a spiritual sense that Elimelech is putting his family at risk. Not surprisingly, Elimelech dies in Moab, leaving Naomi as a widow, raising two sons. The two boys grow up, and not unsurprisingly, they marry local girls, one named Orpah and the other named Ruth, who gives her name to this little book in the Old Testament. After 10 years, the two sons tragically die, neither of them having fathered any children, and they thus leave three women now, widows and childless, and quite vulnerable. Naomi decides to go back to her family in Bethlehem. The famine has lifted there, and she advises her daughters-in-law, Orpah and Ruth, to go back to their families in Moab, and perhaps they could start again. They're not too old, and maybe they could find another husband. She says she's too old to marry again. Orpah goes back to her family and parts quite emotionally from her mother-in-law. Ruth, on the other hand, has had some sort of conversion, we think, in Ruth 1, and she decides, no, rather than go back to my family who worship Chemosh, I'm going to come with you, Naomi, and I'm going to follow you. Wherever you go, I will go, and your God will be my God. And so she now entrusts herself into the hands not only of Naomi, but also Naomi's God, the God we know as the Lord. So the two women then make their sad and lonely journey back to Bethlehem. And it's not a happy homecoming. The people in Bethlehem are interested. Here's Naomi who left us so long ago. What's happened? And Naomi meets them with a rather sad face and tells them, I left Bethlehem full. In other words, I had a husband and children, but now I've come back empty. Don't call me Naomi anymore. My name means sweetness or pleasant. It's a good name. Don't call me that. Call me Mara, which means bitter. If I went away sweet, I've come back bitter. She's very, very dejected, and she's blaming God, and we don't really find that surprising. So we begin chapter 2 with that sort of cloud over the relationship of the two women, Naomi, the mother-in-law, and Ruth, the daughter-in-law. And we wonder what could possibly change to help Naomi find some hope. Well, the hope comes in a person in chapter 2, verse 1, and he's a bloke. The hope comes in the person of a bloke named Boaz. In chapter 2, verse 1, he's described as a man of standing. And men here, young men and older men, I want you to take notice of Boaz. You may not have heard that name before, but he's a success. He's a successful businessman, and he's a successful employer. His name has implications of strength, and it may be that he's also a warrior. He has a feeling around him because of his name and his background of strength and valor. He's good with money, and he's good with people. He's made a go of life. He owns things. He has a work team who's responsible for. They answer to him. But I think one of the most admirable things about him is he's a man of honour and he's a man of faith. And that will come through not only in chapter 2, but also in chapters 3 and 4. So men, if you're here tonight and you don't have any godly role models, if because of the way you've been brought up, you don't maybe have a father figure or father figures in Christ who can role model to you what it means to live as a man, look at Boaz. And even if you do have those role models, you'll still learn something. Look at Boaz. Remember that name, a man of faith and a man worth emulating. I want to particularly draw that out to the young men here. Now, we know that Naomi and Ruth are at the bottom of the social ladder here at the moment. They're widows and they're childless. Now, ladies, I'm sorry, but in those days you needed a man somewhere in your life to guarantee protection. It's changed a little bit now, but even a widow, childless lady now would still be a bit vulnerable. But they're very vulnerable in those days. There's no Centrelink to help them out. They are absolutely at risk. They don't know where the next meal is going to come from. They're in a desperate situation. And it looks like to me at the end of chapter 1 and beginning of chapter 2 that Naomi is probably quite depressed. I think if we had a psychologist or a psychiatrist there in those days, they'd probably say, yes, she is depressed. Ruth, on the other hand, begins chapter 2 by saying to herself, I think, if we're going to survive, me and my mother-in-law, even in this vulnerable situation, if we're going to survive, I've got to go out to work. And so she decides to try a hand at gathering scraps of grain. It's called gleaning. Now, in the Old Testament law required that the farmers, when they harvested the fields, they left bits of grain in the corners and at the edges for people who were the most vulnerable. And Deuteronomy, they're called the alien, the fatherless, and the widow. And Ruth is at least two of those. She's a foreigner, she's an alien, and she's a widow. So Ruth goes out to do what the law allows her to do, which is to pick up the leftover grain. Now, you need to understand that this is a very menial job, a very poor-paying job, and it's full of risk. Just imagine, for example, a young lady arrives here in Melbourne tonight with not even the money to pay for a backpacker's hostel. And she says to you, or she says to me, oh, look, I'm just going to go into the city and try and get a job washing dishes tonight. And I'm not quite sure where I'm going to sleep. Now, we would recognise that that's not a very good idea. She could easily be taken advantage of, couldn't she? So this is the sort of situation that Ruth is in. She is very vulnerable and could easily be taken advantage of. So when she leaves home that morning, she doesn't know where she's going to end up working and whether she'll get much food at all. But she goes off into the fields, and it's here that we meet Boaz. I imagine Boaz has a very deep voice. How are we to understand this meeting of Ruth and Boaz? Now, many people read chapter 2 of Ruth as a romance. It's a love story. It's an ancient version of the TV program The Farmer Wants a Wife. Here's the handsome, rugged farmer on one side. Here's the pretty young girl on the other side. He looks at her, she looks at him, and without saying anything, he says, you want to share love and land and lambing seasons? And she says, you bet I do. Now, I don't actually think that's what Ruth 2 is all about. But if you know the end of the story of Ruth, you could imagine thinking, this is a happy ever after romance. But I think if we jump too quickly to engagements and wedding bells, then we miss some of the depth of what is going on in Ruth 2. Let me point out a couple of other things that I think are worth noticing. Firstly, let me draw attention to the godly workplace. You see, Boaz has created a godly atmosphere in the fields. We see that in how he greets the harvesters. It's only a little thing, but he says, the Lord be with you, and they say back to him, the Lord bless you. It's a very small thing, but it's a bit like saying grace, I think. It reminds us that there are people of faith around. I was at a restaurant last night with my kids. We said grace, And I noticed a table away, people we didn't know, later on when they sat down, they also said grace. You actually think, well, they're believers here in this public place. Now, when Ruth overhears Boaz speaking to his harvesters, I think her heart lifts a little bit, not with romance, but with a sense that just maybe God is here a little bit in these fields. God is honoured amongst these men, these tough harvesters. God is respected here. And there's just the faintest sense that God is there, and that would give Ruth a bit of a lift as she's working. And what has made this most, what has made God's presence obvious is not some sort of mysterious spiritual thing going on. It's the arrival of one godly man, a man who's not afraid to put the name of the Lord on his lips, and he's also the boss. So already I hope you can see one of the implications for the workplace. Now, the second thing I want to draw out is that Ruth's request pushes boundaries. Ruth knows that she should be allowed to gather up the grain at the edges and in the corners. She doesn't have to ask permission to do that, like you don't need to ask permission to go and walk on the footpath. But she's not happy just with gathering at the edges. In verse 7, the foreman tells Boaz that Ruth has actually asked permission to gather in amongst the harvesters. She doesn't want to just be out on the edges. She actually wants to be in the fields where the bulk of the grain is and have permission to gather there. You see, inside her, she's feeling the weight of Naomi's emptiness, and she wants to come back with enough food to at least give Naomi a good dinner. But she takes a huge risk in asking because she's overstepping the mark here, and she could easily be told by the foreman, presumably, although he waits till Boaz arrives, she could easily be just told, get lost. You've asked for too much. And in asking this, she's actually challenging the depth of Boaz's faith. Is he someone who just spouts off religious words like praise the Lord, but actually is a hard-hearted profiteer? You know, how deep is he, is his faith? Is he a genuinely good man or not? And it's the same test that Jesus would put to the Pharisees. Do they actually understand the essence of the law, or are they just really hard-hearted? Now, Boaz knows the letter of the law. He knows that he is supposed to let her glean, let her take the grain at the edges. But she's challenging him to obey the spirit of the law, which says, feed her, care for her. And by implication, that question, I think, and his response challenges us as to how far we might go in caring for those who are worse off than ourselves. So Ruth puts this question out into the workplace, and everything else in chapter 2 will depend on how Boaz reacts to this challenge. My third point then is blessings flow. Boaz's response is astonishing. He's not offended by her at all, by her request. Far from it. He's so moved by her situation that he decides to pour out blessing. He has control over the economy of this situation. He decides to let this flow towards this poor girl. Notice in the chapter what he gives her. He gives her a secure food supply for the rest of the harvest period by saying, "You keep coming to these fields. I'll make sure you're looked after." He gives her safety by allowing her, almost commanding her, to mingle with the other servant girls. It's like a little small group support network. He says, "You stick with the girls and you'll be safe." He gives her protection. I love this. He gives her protection by telling the other blokes, the other harvesters, and I reckon there'll be a little bit of menace in his voice when he says this, "Don't you touch her." You can feel that, can't you? If you touch her, if you mess with her, you'll be in trouble with me. And so he sort of provides a protective coat around her, a protective his protection, his name, it protects her. And he tells the men not to embarrass her. Don't play any tricks on her. You look after her. Then he also notices at lunchtime, he says to her, "Come and sit at our table. Come and join in our circle. We've got some cooked food here. You're welcome to have it, and you're welcome to take some home." You see, she's not to be treated like a social leper. She's not out having her lunch in the photocopy room. She's actually in the boardroom with the boss, enjoying lunch. So he's saying, you are welcome in here socially. And he even tells his men to leave extra grain for her so that her harvesting and her work will mean that she'll get so much food that it will be over more than that she expects to make in that day. Now, why does he do this? If you're reading this romantically, you'll say, well, he does this because he's got his eye on her. He wants to impress her. But I don't think Boaz has a romantic intention at all at the moment. And if you read chapter 3, you realise he doesn't. He doesn't see her as a prospective wife at this stage. I've actually heard one preacher preaching about this lunch that you'll see in verse 14 and describing it as Ruth and Boaz's first date. And the preacher draws out some principles about first dates along the lines of, blokes, if you're going to take a girl on a first date, food is good. Food is good. Don't take her to the wrestling. Take her to somewhere where there's food. And notice there are other people there, so go with friends. Don't go on your first date by yourselves. That could be awkward, and, you know, if it doesn't work out, that sort of thing. Now, I don't think there's anything in the text here to say that Boaz has got any of these romantic intentions at all. But you might want to read it a different way. When Ruth asks him why is he being so generous to her, it's because he's heard how godly she has been in looking after Naomi. And he's blessing her because he has heard what a blessing she has been to her mother-in-law. So his blessing of her is an outworking, first of all, of Ruth's faith, and then secondly, of his faith. So you can see why I think blessing is overflowing. You see it in Boaz's prayer in verse 12, where he says, may the Lord repay you for what you've done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. I think that's a lovely image, isn't it, of taking refuge under the wings of the Lord. But Boaz doesn't realise that he's actually going to be the answer to this prayer. He's rewarding her, he's repaying her, and she will eventually come under his wings in a more personal way later in the story. But we'll leave that for the coming weeks. The only thing that remains in chapter 2 is for Ruth to celebrate this momentous day with her mother-in-law. Now, try and put yourself in the shoes of Naomi, this young girl who she's sort of the chaperone for, left early in the morning to go out into the fields. Naomi had no idea where she was going. Ruth didn't know where she was going. What would Naomi be thinking as hour after hour after hour went through the day? Is she okay? What's happening? Where did she end up? Will I find her on the side of the road somewhere? Is she, you know, etc.? It's obviously not a safe time, because you see that when Boaz has to tell the men, you know, you don't harm her and stay in this field so you don't get hurt. So Naomi, I suspect, would be quite tense, wondering what's going on. Then Ruth comes home with enormous amount of grain. It's described as an ephah. One commentator said this would be about 15 times the amount one of the harvesters would have been paid for his day's work. So she's gone out and earned 15 times more than one of the workers. And she's come home with sort of bags and bags of all of this grain. But not only that, she's come home with some of the lunch that's already cooked. So she's got a meal already waiting to give to Naomi. And who knows when Naomi last ate a decent meal. Now, remember what it's like when you're hungry. I've come home from the shops with bags of food and ready to, you know, we have to cook all of this stuff. So there's another hour or an hour and a half, 2 hours of work to be done at home with the bags of food that I've got here. And that's great. We've got food. We'll eat tonight. But imagine the difference when you come in with the hot chicken and the chips under your arm as well. You know which one the kids will go for. They're not going to be helping me unpack the bags, are they? Oh, Dad, you've got some chips. So Ruth comes home with all of this abundant food and a takeaway meal ready for Naomi to eat. And Naomi's mind is spinning. She's going, where did you glean today? Where did you work? And without even waiting for the answer, she prays, bless the man who took notice of you today. And then Ruth tells her a little bit of information. She says, the field that I worked in belonged to Boaz. And as soon as Naomi hears that name, she puts two and two together in her head. The narrator has told us in verse 1 that Naomi is related to Boaz through her dead husband Elimelech. But it's only now that we see what the significance of that is. The news about Boaz turns Naomi from bitterness to blessing. The Lord bless him, she says in verse 20. He's not stopped showing kindness, that Hebrew word which is hesed, to the living and the dead, a reference to Naomi and Ruth, the living, and Elimelech and his sons, the dead. Naomi's mood changes because she knows something that Ruth doesn't know, and that is that Boaz is a close relative. Translation here says in verse 20, a guardian redeemer, or in some other translations, a kinsman redeemer. That means that Boaz is a figure of redemption in the story. And what this sort of relative is supposed to do is quite practical. He's meant to look after members of the family, the extended family, when they get into trouble. So it could be something like this. A member of our family has been sold into slavery due to war and has been taken off by some other army. The kinsman redeemer would raise the money to pay the ransom in order to redeem the relative back. Or it might be one member of our family has fallen on hard times, we've had to sell a field in order to pay the bills. The kinsman redeemer would raise money to buy the land back so that the land would stay in the family. Or there's been some trouble in the community and one of my relatives has been killed, the kinsman redeemer would have to avenge that death. Or slightly more sort of poignantly for this story, if a brother dies, the kinsman redeemer would ensure that there was an heir for the dead brother by marrying the widow. Now the gloom lifts off Naomi as soon as she puts these bits of the jigsaw together in her mind. The man's field you worked in today is Boaz, one of our kinsman redeemers. And the gloom lifts. Now, why is this? Some people would say that the gloom lifts immediately off Naomi because she's hearing wedding bells. She's starting to plan in her head immediately Ruth and Boaz's future. In a blink, she has moved from bitter Mara to bridal matchmaker. Now, I don't know what goes on in most women's minds. I don't think I know what goes on in any woman's mind. And I don't know if Naomi thinks that far that quickly. But it is possible. Who knows how far she goes in thinking about Boaz as their kinsman redeemer. But I think at this stage, to be true to the text, I think her mood change is tied up more with her gratitude to God. You see, what I think is going on is when she says his kindness has never stopped, she is reflecting on this quality that we would call love your neighbour as yourself type of love, this compassion that he has shown to Ruth and therefore blessed her Naomi, that reminds Naomi that God has not abandoned her. See, this is a characteristic of God, this hesed love. And she's probably in her bitterness thought, God has abandoned me. Everything good in my life has just disappeared. And now there's this sense that this, through Boaz's kindness, that this love, this kindness of God is still available to Naomi. And I think that's what starts to lift her spirit and begins a bit of healing in her. She realizes her life is not empty after all. So this love is shown in very practical ways, in grain and food, and also in Boaz's protection and attitude towards Ruth, and it lifts her spirits and gives her hope. So at the end of chapter 2, you've got a very different Naomi to at the end of chapter 1. Now, let me just stop there, and I want to just draw a few threads together around the topical theme for tonight, which is to do with workplace relationships. Not immediately that topic would jump out at you at Ruth 2, but that's what I've been asked to reflect on. Let me look again at Ruth, the character of Ruth, and the character of Boaz, and just draw a few conclusions. Ruth is a single lady. She has lots of issues, as we can see from the story. She's widowed. She's childless. Some people might look at her as used goods. She is trying to support a depressed mother-in-law. She has very little on her CV that would indicate she is a good employee. Anyone who would take her on would feel like we're taking a risk taking this lady on. There's a lot there in the background. Now, I think one of the things we should notice about Ruth is that Ruth refuses to be defeated by life. She wants to get out there and try and make ends meet. She's a determined, risk-taking woman of God. And I think there's a lot to learn from her in how to respond when life is tough. There'll be people here tonight who feel a weight of grief, maybe a weight of sadness about how things are going in life, things that haven't happened or things that have happened. There'll be people who are feeling a weight of obligation in carrying others that you're responsible for, like Ruth was feeling responsible for Naomi. Now, there are times when I think that weight can become overwhelming and you feel like you just don't know which way is up. And you see that a bit in Naomi, I think, at the start of chapter 2. But Ruth is someone who says to herself, I'm not going to let this defeat me. I believe God is good, and I'm going to go out there and take a risk. I'm going to try something. I'm going to put myself out into the workforce. I don't really know what I'm going to find, but she takes the risk. And I think we have to admire that sort of courage. And notice how she then works. She works hard all day long. It's a very, very tough job. I suspect she comes home with a tired back, dirt under the fingernails. Her dress would probably be muddy, that sort of thing. It's not a nice job. But she comes home having been seen by the boss as an honest worker, and she's won respect from the other workers. I suspect she comes home, even though she's tired, carrying this load of food, I suspect she comes home full of a sense of achievement. She's proud, I think, of what she's done and praising God that she's been blessed by Boaz. Now, sometimes we see work as a necessary evil, but Ruth shows us that work can actually be a means of redemption. What I mean by that is it can be that you might feel your world is just so unfair and everything is black and grim that you lose energy for living. But sometimes when you can get out of that type of rut, out of that type of sort of depression perhaps even, and find work that is fulfilling, you actually start to feel better. You start to feel more positive. Work can be a means of redemption. The heavy heart that Ruth brought back from Moab won't be healed instantly, but I think we see at the end of Ruth 2 the sense that life is going to improve little bit by little bit. So those are some comments about Ruth, who is a hard-working, courageous woman. Secondly, some comments about Boaz. Boaz is an example of a godly boss and a godly man in the workforce. We see that in how he speaks, how he treats Ruth, and how he treats his workers. His willingness to give Ruth more than required by the letter of the law shows that he has real faith and real compassion for this young lady. Now, these days, we often hear of companies wanting to develop social responsibility. That is, they want to put something back into the community and not just feel like they're taking out profit. And in a sense, Boaz is an ancient example of that, but he's not doing that just because it looks good to have a social responsibility committee. He's doing this as a response to God because of his faith. Boaz ensures that the harvesters don't mistreat Ruth and that she has safety among the female workers. In other words, I see him organising his workforce so that there's dignity for all, particularly for the most vulnerable. So you think about the women in the workforce, you think about apprentices in the workforce, think about refugees or people who are coming from other countries, maybe with not the right qualifications. How easy is it in Australian work environment to take advantage of people, maybe not to pay them the right award, maybe not to give them all the particular entitlements that they're due? You know, people can pull the wool over others if they're not aware. And Boaz shows that he won't do that. He will protect the weak ones. Now, a question you could ask yourself is, how could you be a figure of redemption in your workplace? How could you be good news in the workplace that you're in? How could you somehow, just even in little ways, if you're not the boss, if you're just one of the team, how can you actually be a godly person in that situation? Notice that Naomi twice blesses Boaz in verses 19 and 20 because of his generosity to Ruth. Now, men, think about this. What an honour it is as a man to be seen by women as a blessing. Just think about that. If you're in the workforce, or some of you are students and you're going into the workforce, do the women who work with you, or even work for you, will they bless God in whatever way they understand that because you're there? Will they say, it's great to have Bill in the office. I'm so grateful I work for Peter. It's tremendous that Matthew is one of our team. They might not use the language of blessing, but would that be their response? Or will their response be, oh, I'm glad he's resigned. He was a pain in the neck. Or I'm never going to work for him again. Will that be their response? See, Naomi blesses God, blesses Boaz because of the man of honour and the man of faith he is. What a privilege it is. What a thing to aim for if you're a young bloke here tonight. Will you protect the women who you work with? Will you generously respond to their needs so that they feel cared for and safe in the work environment where you are? So we finish chapter 2. Naomi and Ruth are still two vulnerable widows, but now we know that someone cares and that will make all the difference. Do come back next week. We're going to see over the next few weeks how the blessing that starts to occur here in chapter 2 will flow out into blessing for the whole nation of Israel as the child, the great-grandchild of Boaz and Ruth, who is named King David, will come and be a blessing for the whole nation. And eventually, one of their later ancestors, another son in the line of David born in Bethlehem, will be born the Lord Jesus himself. But I don't want to get ahead of the story. I'd like you to come back next week, because next week in chapter 3, there is one of the most unusual ways you will ever find in how to find yourself a husband or how to find yourself a wife. You will not find this in any magazine at Coles. This is only in the Bible. Chapter 3 could be called Sleepless in Bethlehem. So make sure you come back.